This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Elements are the building blocks of the universe as we know it. But there are some who are looking to push the frontiers of matter further than ever before by creating their own elements. Our conversation about the vanishing element of helium reminded us of an earlier interview with Rob Dunn, who wrote about the element hunters for National Geographic. So when prepping for this interview, I was talking with my colleagues thinking that the periodic table was done. Give us a little summary of the process of adding discoveries to the periodic table. How are they even decided?
Well, so it's interesting. So your intuition is right that the periodic table in terms of the elements that we find around us is done. But in the 1940s, scientists started to try to make elements that don't currently exist, in essence, smashing other elements together. And part of that endeavor is just to sort of see what science can do, maybe a little bit like Dr. Frankenstein did with his monster. The other interesting thing is that in the 1950s, it was predicted that maybe if you could make really, really heavy elements, that they might last a long time. And one of the things that defines the periodic table as we know it is that as you produce heavier and heavier elements, as you get up to toward 92, which is the end of the elements that we find outside, they get more and more fleeting. But this prediction suggested that maybe if you got really heavy elements, that they might last minutes or hours or days or maybe even thousands or millions of years. And if they did, it would actually change what we know about how every other element works, because it would mean that the insides of the elements are actually arranged in something like shells. And so what scientists wanted to do was to try to produce these really heavy elements, both to see if they could, but also to see if our understanding of the entire universe and the stuff out of which everything we love or hate is made is true.
Well, one of the ways that you draw us into this process is through one of these few people, a very driven, very interesting scientist named Yuri Oganessian, is what I'm guessing that you pronounce his name. He's working out of a lab in Dubna. This is a city north of Moscow. So how is he going about creating these new heavy elements, as you put it?
Started in on the story in around 1978. He figured out what might be a new way to make heavier and heavier elements, which was to take something like plutonium and to sling a sort of medium weight element like calcium at it. And so he imagined that if you could do this, you could make really heavy things, and you might make something as heavy as 114. And if you could do that, you could test this theory. And 114 came to be described as being on this island of stability. And so in 1978, he starts on this, and his first real headway is in some ways in 1998. And so all these years later, when he finally has everything together to try to produce 114, and he slams these atoms together at trillions of miles an hour, and when he does, he produces a single atom of 114. And as he does, the question becomes, how long does it last? Does it last longer than 113? And if it does, to him, that will mean that everything we thought about all of the elements was wrong. And in fact, the centers of the elements or the atoms are arranged in these sort of predictable ways. And in fact, 114 does last longer. And then he goes on to produce multiple versions of 114 and 113, 115, 116, 117, and 118. And explore this whole landscape. And so he's just this one guy, and it's all their lab really focuses on. And they've done it through the hardest years of recent Russian history. You know, they do it in this teeny town, and Oganessian could not be a more pleasant, affable guy. And so it's really an amazing situation.
And because you are writing for National Geographic, there are these fantastic photographs of the lab. It makes it look like this Cold War era, you know, frozen in time industrial lab in Dubna. Who's funding this work?
Originally, all this work was very contentious. That, you know, the Russians fought with the Americans for who was first, and the Germans fought with the Russians. But now these endeavors are so difficult that they're actually really international collaborations. And so the lab in Dubna is partially funded by the U.S., partially funded by Eastern Europeans, partially funded by Germans, and then also funded by Russians. And so what was once this really heated scientific endeavor is now something that could only happen with international collaboration. But it does look like a Cold War facility in many ways. So I originally described the cyclotron that they used to slam these atoms together as being built in 1968. Mm-hmm. And he said that a cyclotron is like a Russian woman. You should never mention her age. But it is. It's, you know, it's a 1968 piece of equipment that they're doing the most sophisticated science in the world on. So it's a pretty amazing thing.
Well, Rob, so I want to ask you, what happens? I mean, after you create something like he's replicated a few times, this 114, 120, 126, what then happens? Does it have to go through a sort of jurying process to be named onto the periodic table?
Yeah, so there's a many-year jurying process. So 114 and 116 have both been through that process, and 114 ended up being named for Oganessian's advisor, Flerov, and 116 comes to be named for Lawrence Livermore Lab. And now we wait for the other new elements that they've found, but have not yet been officially accepted. So there will be more.
And that's Rob Dunn, a biologist and writer at North Carolina State University. You'll find a link to read his National Geographic article on element hunters at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. When you think about school science fair projects, maybe it calls to mind baking soda volcanoes or styrofoam models of the planets. More to the point, that's what a lot of students think of and what they enter in science fairs. But to a lot of real scientists, projects like that are missed opportunities. Rather than just building models, they believe children as young as 8 or 10 can do actual science and discover new things. Adam Hochberg reports.
When 14-year-old Kyle Gazzillo was getting ready for this year's school science fair in Dalton, Massachusetts, he had a pretty good idea what he wanted to enter.
I was hoping to combine inside a bottle baking soda and vinegar and seeing which ones explode the best.
Of course, it's easy to understand why teenagers gravitate toward projects that explode. Those baking soda rockets and baking soda volcanoes are old standards at science fairs, so popular that you'll find more than 100 videos on YouTube of kids making them. But the more Kyle thought about building effervescent bottle bombs, the less excited he became.
That's something a lot of people know how to do. It's just messy and looks cool. It has no science behind it besides the reaction with baking soda and vinegar or whatever you want to mix.
So by the time we met them at the Massachusetts State Science and Engineering Fair, Kyle and his research partner, Owen Alabozic, were showing off a very different experiment.
We did our project on standing and sitting and how it affects your memory.
Yeah, because when I study, I tend to like to stand, and maybe I was wondering if that affected people. And it did. Standing improved most people's memory.
That new project, one the eighth graders thought of themselves, earned third place in the state finals. And it's the kind of thing the fair's executive director, Cora Beth Abel, wants to see more of. Original research that relates to students' own lives, rather than demonstrations they copy from the internet or from books.
When students own their research, they care about it, and especially when it relates to the world around them. That student really gets excited and inspired in a way that reading a textbook just can't do.
The Massachusetts Fair has promoted that so-called inquiry-based science for years. But when it comes to the smaller fairs that local schools might hold, projects still often lean toward the familiar standbys.
When my daughter had a science fair, what she came home with was the idea to demonstrate something we already know.
That's North Carolina State University biologist Rob Dunn. He helps write a blog about bugs and microbes called Your Wildlife. Lately, he's been on a crusade to improve science fairs that started when his second-grade daughter showed him a list of suggested projects.
The standard sheet of paper had volcanoes. It had lots and lots of beans. You could do a collection of leaves. But what nobody was telling these kids is that even as second graders, they can do science that produces results to questions we don't know the answer to.
Dunn says most kids don't realize there are a lot of questions like that. So on their blog, Dunn and his colleague Holly Menninger asked readers to suggest projects that allow young people to do real science. They got more than 100 ideas.
So what do ants do when it rains? What do spiders in our house eat? What effect does the please pick up after your dog sign actually have on the removal of dog poop from a community?
Those projects focus on things kids see every day and could even yield some new information. But Menninger concedes they also involve something of a leap of faith, because unlike exploding bottles, original projects can have unpredictable results, or no useful results at all.
This happens to scientists all the time, too, that your hypothesis could have been wrong. And I think that's great. I think that sometimes some of the most exciting discoveries are the things that we don't anticipate.
But who wins a grand prize in a science fair with an experiment that doesn't come up with a result? We want something that goes boom or makes a lot of mold. Those are the ones that win the prizes.
I mean, that's a culture change, I think, sort of steering people away from the final product and focusing more on the process.
Menninger says a lot of kids are ready to do that. The bigger challenge is getting buy-in from adults.
I just have probably the shortest slideshow in the world, I hope.
At Western Carolina University, biology professor Kevin Catley manages a regional science fair and leads these workshops to prepare teachers for it. He says some adults make the fairs worse, parents who do the work for their children, or teachers who provide little guidance.
There's no question in my mind that 80% of the teachers that routinely do a science fair are not competent themselves, and this is no criticism, this is a critique of their educational experience because they've had no research background. So they find it very difficult to advise students, and the quality is pretty bad.
Catley says there's no quick fix for what he calls cookie-cutter science fairs. He says it will take better training for teachers and more support for science in general. But at fairs that have changed their culture, you can see the difference.
And next we have from Taunton High School, Olivia.
As the prizes were handed out at the Massachusetts Fair, the winners ranged from complex projects that studied topics like gene mutation to simple things like a student who found a way to make fluffier cupcakes. What the winners had in common is that they were fresh, scientifically sound, and potentially useful. And there wasn't a baking soda rocket among the bunch. I'm Adam Hoffman.
And that story came to us from Adam Hochberg as part of the STEM Story Project, distributed by PureX and made possible with funding from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation. Coming up, we're going to take a closer look at the potentially deadly art form of nitrate film with a report on the world's most dangerous film festival. Stick around for that story when word of mouth continues.